Good evening, everybody. My name is Ed. I'm an alcoholic. It's great to be here. I want to thank Billy first for asking me to come down here to God's country. I asked some people up in Northern Virginia where I'm from what I should think about when I'm coming down here, and the first thing they said to me was, watch the cops, because you will get stopped, about 1 mile over. And so I made sure I did that, but there were already two stopped on the way, so that's fine. No, it's great to be down here. I used to come down here to Charlottesville to the UVA baseball because I coached baseball for a while, and one of the players I coached was on UVA's team, and then he got drafted by the Cubs. So that was great. But I came down here frequently. As Billy said, we both come from the same sponsorship family, and some of you know who my sponsor is. It's Frank J. from California. And he's been my sponsor for 13 years. And I'll tell you a little bit about that as we get later on in the story, but not in the beginning. I don't know why I'm an alcoholic. As most people have tried to figure out, or I suspect you have, how did this happen? And I thought back into my life before and was thinking and obsessing and trying to figure out, is it possible? And what I came up with was, at 4 years old, I used to have the habit of sliding down the banister in my house. And this one particular day, I slid down the banister, fell off, split my head open, needed to have 72 stitches, and the doctor stitched me up wrong. And that's the reason I'm an alcoholic, because he didn't put it back in the right way. That's what I came up with. 4 years old was the first experience, really, I had with alcohol, an experience. My dad was an alcoholic, and he was a violent drunk. He never hit me, never hit my sister, but anytime we did anything wrong, he'd come home and beat the crap out of my mother. And we had to watch it. My sister would run into the bedroom and hide under the bed, and to this day, nothing ever happened. She denies every piece of it. But I was right in the middle. I always got in the middle of it. But at 4 years old, I was at my grandfather's house, my dad's dad. And his youngest sister was also an alcoholic. Except she would go to Baltimore and sell herself on the streets to get money to pay for her booze. And she'd come home drunk, and I was at the bottom of the stairs, and my grandfather kicked her downstairs, called her a whore, said all this terrible stuff to her, and she was bleeding, and he was just standing over her, spitting on her. That was my first exposure to what alcoholism really was about, that it is unpredictable, it's violent, it will lead you to places you don't want to be. I didn't understand it, but I saw it. That year at four, I ran away from home. I ran about 5 or 6 blocks up to my aunt's house, and I played with a cigarette lighter all the time. And I lit it, I put it in my pocket, lit, and I caught on fire. So I had a lot of things happen that year that I guess were indicators that I probably would find or look for some route to get out of the pain that life was going to throw at me. The next big exposure to alcoholism was in first grade. I had gone to kindergarten, so I knew my ABCs, I knew basic numerology. Mathematics. And I went to a private Catholic school. And the third day of class, the nun said, can anybody here go to the board and print the letter A? I raised my hand. I was all excited and proud of myself because I could do it. And I go to the board and I put A, B, C. Sit down! Who do you think you are? You smart thing. She screamed at me. Wow. That afternoon, she said, can anybody go to the board and put one? Sure. I go to the board and put 1 plus 1, 2. She was so mad. She said, you'll get your jacket. You will get your desk. You two students help him. Move his desk into the hall. And he'll stay there for 6 weeks until the class catches up to where he is. So I sat in the hall for the first 6 weeks of first grade. I went home that day and I said to my parents, I don't need to go back to school anymore. And they said, what do you mean? I said, I know it all. again, the basis for a lot of problems later when I would start drinking. So at that point, I hated school. I went the first day and loved it, and 3 days later, I didn't want to go back. I went all the way through, failing, going to summer school, failing, going to summer school. Got to seventh grade, and the nun literally brought me up into the front of the class and said, "This is Ed. Ed has no friends. Would someone please be his friend?" Ooh. So I isolated. And it was that year, in seventh grade, at age 12, that I first snuck into my dad's refrigerator and drank a beer. And I liked it. Wow. That was good stuff. So then I started trying some of the other stuff that was in his liquor cabinet. And, oh, I hated it. I wanted to throw it up. It just burnt the whole way down. I tried whiskey. I tried vodka. I like slow gin, which Frank and I can relate to the slow gin stuff, because it tasted like Kool-Aid. And I could drink a lot of that. And I did something else that was kind of strange. A friend of mine worked and lived right across from a hospital, and we would steal ether and get high just by huffing on ether. Well, if you've watched Father Martin's Chalk Talk, that's the same thing as alcohol. It's like inhaling alcohol. It gives you the same effect all the way down the line until you pass out. So I didn't know that at the time, but listening to Father Martin, it makes sense. At any rate, I started at age 12, increased every weekend. I was pretty much a loner. I didn't know what to do. I didn't have a lot of friends. Believe it, looking at me now, in eighth grade, I was 6'1", 125 pounds. The nun called me Dinky. "Hey, Dinky." Oh, God. My father was a semi-professional football player, so he was big. He was a right tackle. And in the Army, he won the middleweight championship for boxing. So he was fit, and he was rigid and disciplined and wouldn't take nothing from nobody. I took a lot of abuse at the Catholic school because I didn't want him to find out what was going on. Because he'd beat the crap out of my mother. Not me. And I was so afraid of that. I got to ninth grade, and in ninth grade, that was the year the Beatles came out. And they had the long hair. And I let my hair grow. And in Catholic school, you weren't allowed to have long hair. So the principal called me in, and he took the shears, and instead of mohawk, went right down the center. He says, "Now you look stupid. Get your hair cut." What was my answer? "To hell with you. I'll do what I want to do." I went and had a drink. I got some more beer, got a six-pack, went up, and there was a construction company. They parked all their dump trucks. We climbed into the back of the dump truck, pulled out about 10 Playboys and a six-pack of beer, and that was great. We just sat there drinking and looking at the pictures. I get warped thinking sometimes. I went into the drugstore one time and asked for a Playboy, and the pharmacist comes. I said, "Do you have any Playboys?" And came one out. They said, "You're awfully young for this." I said, No, I want the Braille edition." Think about that. Never mind. Right. And he looked at me and started laughing. "Get out of here, kid." In 10th grade, that was my worst year. And I'm going through this because this really led up to my daily drinking. In 10th grade is my worst year. I had 49 detentions. I was suspended 10 times. The principal was a big guy, too, and he would call us into his office and give us an option. The option was we were to lay across his desk, drop our pants, and he took that small baseball bat, and he would smack us 10 times on the rear end as hard as he could, and we'd walk out of his office limping, or he'd call our parents. Well, you know the answer to that. I didn't want my parents called. And so I would lay across the desk, but I got revenge. That taught me something that year. Besides drinking, especially when I had something to drink, I was great at getting revenge. The one biology nun, one made me a reformation project. She was going to fix me and whatever it was she was going to do, I don't know. She prayed over me and all this other stuff. And she put me and this other kid in charge of a fish tank, a saltwater fish tank. It was beautiful. We had starfish and we had all the different colored fish. And Friday, my friend and I snuck into the school, emptied it halfway out, and filled it up with formaldehyde. So on Monday, all the fish were floating on top of the... And we thought that was cool. No? Another weekend, we snuck in and went into the lab, and we switched the water jets with the gas jets on underneath. Because Monday was Bunsen burner day. And so the nun comes in, and she's very rigid, and on count of three, everybody turn on your burners, one, two, three, boom, water everywhere. It was terrific. That's the stupid stuff I did, and then I get suspended. Imagine that. What I discovered was, any time there was a problem, if I went and had a few beers, I didn't care. And I started to experiment with other things, beer, liquor, but I'm an alcoholic. And I always, always, always started with alcohol. If I took a hiatus from alcohol, I would come back to it. It was my drug of choice. That's what I wanted because I could just take that sip. It just hit you. So I did that for I don't know how long. I got out of high school with a 1.9. So I don't want to hear anybody in here tell me you're too dumb to make it, that you can't make it, that you didn't succeed in high school, because you can. I got out and no college wanted me except for a community college, and they take everybody. And I went to a community college, and I was really good at numbers. And I don't know why I was good at numbers. Some people say it's because I was good at grams and ounces and weights and that kind of things. And it may be. Maybe that's how I understood it, because I could relate to it. But I majored in accounting. So I went to a junior college or community college and got a degree in accounting. From a 1.9, I went to a 3.7. And the dean called me in and says, "Why are you on probation? You're smart." I said, "I don't know. You put me there." And I started drinking heavily, more every other day. And it went from a 3.7 down to a 3.5, to a 3, to a 2.8, to a 2.5, to a 2.2. I had a habit of doing only what I had to do to get by. Well, I graduated with an associate degree. Then I went to the University of Baltimore, and I majored in the same thing, accounting and business, except I lived three blocks from the Strip. Anybody know the Strip in Baltimore? Baltimore Street? Or should I say Baltimore Street? That's where all the strip clubs were and all the alcohol places were. And at that point, I had just turned 21. I walked into the bar 2 minutes after midnight to get my drink legally. And here, let me give it to you for free. And it was great. I went there every single night. And I started hooking up with hookers. I didn't care. Whoever wanted to come home with me, let's go. It didn't matter. I need to fulfill me, no matter what the cost was. And I finally, after I was on probation at the University of Baltimore, graduated with a 2.0. My junior year, friends of mine were in the seminary. And I was St. Mary's in Baltimore. And they came to me and they said, "Why don't you come to Mass with us? I think you'll like it better than what you grew up with." And I said, "Okay." So I went over to the seminary, went to their Mass with them. And it was good. The music was good. The preaching was good. It wasn't like the parish. It wasn't like the church I grew up with these old farts that all lectured about God's going to send you to hell. They had modern talks and modern sermons and things you could relate to. And in my senior year, when I graduated from the University of Baltimore, I had a keen alcoholic decision. If I enter seminary, people will respect me. They'll look up to me. They won't criticize me. They won't tear me apart. And guess what? I entered seminary. When I got to St. Mary's, They frowned. This was the transition from Vatican II. They frowned on people going to seminary and not going out on dates and experiencing life. They wanted you to go on dates. They frowned on people not drinking. Wow. I needed rules, and there were no rules here. If you came in before 2 o'clock on a weekend night, they wrote you up psychologically. Something's wrong with you. You're not really a living human being, are you? So you started to act out, and that just gave me permission to do what I wanted to do, whether I had the cleric on or whether I didn't. I went to Mount St. Mary's, to major seminary, except they had a Rathskeller on campus because it's a college campus besides the seminary. And I remember the rector called me in one time, and Father Flynn, I don't know if anybody met Father Harry Flynn. He was the rector, and he called me and said, "And in case you haven't noticed, there are women on this campus." Yes, I know. I started working at the radio station as a disc jockey. I got my commercial broadcasting license, and I worked every night, 8 to 12, on the radio station. But we were supposed to be in before 11. That was our rule. So I would have a friend of mine go in and put a little pebble in the door, and I would sneak back in and be up, and I rarely made morning prayers, which were at 7:30. And I got called in on that one, and he said to me basically, I told him, "I'm sitting in the choir loft." Well, if everybody sat in the choir loft and said they were, it'd fall in. Get your butt down to morning prayers. But every single night, I would open the Rathskeller, go to work, come back, and close the Rathskeller on campus. There's a picture of me in one of the yearbooks, and I don't know which one it is, but I'm standing on a soccer field with this huge bucket of beer. Because that's how I drank the beer up there, was with buckets. We used to have chugging contests, and I don't know what the record is, but I thought I held it for a long time. It was 14 seconds for me for one bucket, which is a gallon of beer. That's pretty good. And we used to have contests where we'd line them up 10 glasses on the bar. Well, I always paid the bartender an extra couple bucks, and on the other opponent guy, he put the third or fourth one warm beer. So if you're chugging cold, you hesitate just a second. You beat them every time. But my revenge got really bad. Nobody dared cross me if I was drinking because they would pay for it. For example, this is in seminary. The guy that lived across the hall from me, I knew Bill Veeck really well, who owned the Chicago White Sox. And he had given me tickets to go to the World Series in 76 to see the Cincinnati Reds and New York Yankees play. Well, so I went there, and I gave a key to my room to my friend, and when I got back, they had sabotaged my room, and I swore revenge. I mean, everything was messed up. So he went home one weekend. The first guy always used baby shampoo. So the shower was like catacorner from my room. So when he went in the shower, I snuck into the shower, took the baby shampoo, emptied it halfway out, filled it the rest of the way up with Nair, and put the cap back on. You know what Nair is? Well, he's washing his hair, and then all of a sudden I hear this scream because his hair is coming out in globs. Oh, it's great. I never admitted to it yet. He doesn't know who did it, so I don't know when I'll admit that. That's probably an amends I still need to make. At any rate, the other guy is from Pittsburgh, and it was wintertime, and we were on the third floor, and he always kept his window open a little. He wouldn't give us the key. So I went out, got a ladder, brought up a garden hose into the room, went to the store, bought 24 boxes of instant Jell-O. I took tin foil and duct tape, put it on the door. I emptied all 24 boxes of Jell-O in the room, knelt on his bed with a broom, brought the hose up, filled it 4 inches deep, and stirred it up and left the window open. So it was in the teens and 20s up in the mountains. And when he got back on the weekend, he couldn't open his door, and I hear all this loud noise, and I, "Let me help you." And we're banging the door, and all of a sudden, he opens his broom, and it's 4 inches of Jell-O. Solid. Crazy stuff. Here's one more crazy story I did when I was drinking. In the spring, the copperheads come out up in the mountains, Western Maryland. I went out and caught 18 copperheads, put them in a burlap bag, took them down to the science professor. He said to me, "Get them the hell out of here." So I took them, emptied them on the soccer field. Crazy stuff. I wasn't afraid of anything when I drank. The fear somehow disappeared. How I made it through, I don't know. But I got through seminary. I got ordained. I got sent to a parish for 5 years, and that didn't last because we had a charge account at the liquor store, which was located right across the street. Now, you figure that one out. One of the proposals I had made when I was in seminary was that we install a beer machine like a soda machine. We just take the soda cans out and put the beer cans in. And they were afraid the college kids would be coming in and raiding that machine, so they denied it. But that's my thinking. My thinking is distorted and crazy. After about 8 years in the parish, they said to me, "We think you need to go to treatment." I said, "Well, I don't think so." And they said, "Well, you're going anyway." So I had two of the Monsignors escort me into a drug treatment center. And I go down there, and I look around, and the first thing I said to the receptionist was, "Is there anybody here like me?" "Oh, we've got a lot like you. You'll like it here." And they said, "At the treatment center, we only need to evaluate you for a week, and then we'll decide whether you need treatment or not." Great, I got this made. Because I was a player. I could talk to anybody at any time about anything you wanted to talk about. Let's talk. The end of the week, they called me in, and they said, "Well, we haven't decided. We need another week." Two thoughts went through my head. One was, well, maybe I haven't convinced. Just playing this out a little bit more, and I can get out of here. And the other one was, what the hell is taking so long? Let's get this over with. So we went another week. They called me in at the end of that week, and they said, okay, we need another 2 weeks. So I stayed there a month on evaluation. At the end of the month, they said, "We think you have a problem. We're going to recommend that you go to treatment. You can go here or you can go out to the Midwest to this other treatment center." And I said, "Which one's shorter?" Without even thinking, which one's shorter? They said, "Well, we're listed as 6 months and they're 9 months." I said, let's get going. Signed it here. And I made a decision that day to do anything I had to do to get out of the treatment center. I would tell me to do it, and I'll do it. So they said, "We want you to write a drug history." I wrote a 60-page drug history paper. All war stories. Single-spaced. Footnoted. Handed it in. And they kind of looked at it and said, "What's this?" I said, "You wanted a drug history." And they gave me this one counselor that I call the Iron Maiden. She's this little twerp, little person. So she said to me one time, "You know, Ed, you're a perfectionist, and we're going to break it. I will no longer accept anything handed in from you that's perfect. The margins can't be perfect. The typing can't be perfect. You can't have a perfectly footnote. If you do, I'll give it back to you to do it again." So I remember about a week later, I came in, handed her something, and she said, "No, do it again. It's perfect." And so I was so angry, I took a black magic marker and went, "Is that good enough?" Screamed at her. Because whether you know it or not, I probably a lot like some of you. I was full of rage. Little tiny things would tick me. Little things would just irk me. And I'd want to choke them and kill them. I remember I was sitting in a group one time, and I was so ticked off about something. And the counselor says, "Ed, do you think you want to share?" "No, you don't want me to share." "Yeah, the group would like to hear what you have to say." And I stood up, and I'm a big guy. I stood up and I said, "I want to lift you up, throw you out through that window so your rear end lands on that church steeple and you can't talk for 17 years. Boy, did she get scared. But I didn't have any anger. Wow. The first thing they did was they put us on these, what I call, short buses and took us to meetings of AA. God, I hated that short bus. I felt like a retard. You pull into the meeting and everybody knew where you were coming from. Everybody. Where'd I go? To the back of the room. I didn't want to talk to you. I didn't want you to talk to me. I didn't want to hear what you had to say. Don't touch me. Don't hug me. Don't give me your number. I'll just throw it away. I'm not interested. The first meeting we went to, and I still remember, I don't know why I do, but I can still remember it. The leader of the meeting talked about the D.C. police out to get him because he had 371 parking tickets. I said, I never had a parking ticket like that. I don't got a problem. The third meeting I went to, and if you have this problem, it's not on you, it's on me. He talked about the fifth step. Admitted to God, to ourselves, another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. And in that fifth step, he said, I need to admit to somebody else, to all of you, that I used to go in certain summers down to my uncle's farm, and I used to play around with the sheep. I just put my head down, said, I don't like sheep that way. This is not for me. I didn't want to go back. I didn't have a choice. In order to get out of the treatment, they said, you see those steps on the wall? That's what you got to do to get out of treatment. So I went down the list. And I saw 9, make amends. I've done that so many times, I'll do it again. Picked up the phone, started calling people, making amends, and they were hanging up on me. I don't want to hear from you. I've heard your sorry story long enough. Click, 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 click. They didn't want to hear from me. Eventually, after 6 months, my counselor said to me, Ed, when are you going to enter treatment? You haven't done anything to enter treatment. You haven't showed me that you really want to stay sober. In the back of my head, I held this reservation. The reservation was, one day I'll prove you all wrong. And I will be able to go out and drink again and to hell and screw all of you. I don't care. Wow. So at 6 months, I went to my counselor and says, okay, I probably need to share at a meeting. I'm not an alcoholic, so how do I introduce myself? And she laughed at me. She said, well, tell them you're powerless over alcohol. So I tried that. I'm Ed. I'm powerless over alcohol. And you laughed at me. Keep coming back, kid. Oh, God. That didn't work. Eventually, I started sharing and saying I'm an alcoholic because what I'm good at is telling you what you want to hear, not what I really believe. And I said it, but I didn't believe it. I went all the way through treatment. I got out of treatment. The church says, we don't want you back. You're too much of a problem. You've caused too much hassle. You've injured too many people. You need to find a new occupation. What do you want to do? I said, well, always wanted to get my PhD. They said, fine. Why don't you enroll in school and get a PhD? So I enrolled in a graduate school, and here's something I do not recommend you do. Do not move from treatment into a college dormitory. That's what I did. You name it, it's available. There was one point where I was depressed about something, and I opened my door, and one of the other students had put under my door 4 hits of acid. So I thought that maybe this could help you a little bit. And what went through my mind was if my hands are a little wet and I pick it up, maybe I could get a little buzz. That's the thinking I had. When I moved into the college dormitory, I went to a liquor store. And I put up on my shelf a security blanket. 151, 100 Smirnoff, all the top grain alcohol. I had gotten a friend of mine to bring back moonshine from Ireland, 180 proof, so that was up there. And all these bottles of liquor were up there just in case I needed it. I went to all the parties where alcohol and drugs were available. Because why? They're the people I could relate to. I fit right in with them. But I went with my Diet Coke. So I drank my Diet Coke. Meetings went from 7 meetings to 6 meetings to 5 to 4 to 3 to 2 to 1. This one particular day in December, I went to a meeting, raised my hand, I shared at the meeting. I called my sponsor at the time, wasn't Frank. And that night, two girls said to me, Ed, we'll watch you and make sure you don't drink too much. Have one. And I had one. And I had two. And I left the party ticked off because there wasn't enough left and I wanted more. And that, can you relate to that? I wanted more. We all went back to my room. The two girls and I got naked. We got in bed. And I blacked out. I don't remember what happened. When I woke up the next morning, they were gone. I haven't seen them since then. And that was back in 1987. So that's been a while. 22 years. So I don't know. I suspect there's another amends that needs to be made. Who knows? What really scares me is like when I go to a convention. This happened up in Hagerstown. I went to a Maryland convention up there, and this one girl from the balcony shouts on me, "Hey, Ed! Yeah? Remember me? No. You don't remember that night? What night? We were at the radio station, and you and I..." Never mind, stop. That kind of stuff scares me. How many blackouts did I have? Probably quite a few. I have no idea what I did during my blackouts. That's scary. Because there are a lot of people out there, as long as I drank, that probably need some kind of amends. At any rate, when I came into the program, when I actually entered the program after that, and the relapse, the next morning after the relapse, I went back to a meeting. I sat in the other corner, and I sat there with my head down, and I cried. Because you all were right, and I was wrong, and I was an alcoholic. And I didn't want to be. I was at this dorm, and some of you may like this, I don't know. I had this one girl who stalked me. Every class I went, she followed me. She knew when I went to the cafeteria, and she'd go to the cafeteria and sit opposite me and stare at me. She was on the next floor in the dorm I was at. She'd be waiting outside my room watching me to go to the elevator to go to class. She'd ride. It was spooky. And I've told her two or three times I wasn't interested. I had no attraction to this girl. So eventually, I wrote up a complaint with student services against her. And they called her in and told her she needs to stop stalking me and harassing me, et cetera, et cetera. 2 weeks later, she was back doing it. I wrote another report. 2 weeks later, she was back doing it again. Finally, I looked at her and said, "Please stop following me around." So at that point, I go to class. It's a three-hour night class. When I come out of class, the president of the university, the chief of police, and several other people were waiting for me. They said, "Do you know so-and-so?" I said, "Yeah." They said, "Well, you were the last person to see her alive. She jumped out the six-story window. Killed herself." The president said, "I feel sorry for you." The first thought was, "I need a drink." The second thought is, "Because of you, I need a meeting." And thank God I chose the second and went to a meeting. The third thing I did was call my sponsor. That stuff works, even when tragic things happen. I got a master's degree, so now I have 3 master's degrees, and I got my PhD. Remember, I called Frank, my current sponsor, and told him, "Hey, Frank, I got my PhD today. I graduated." Don't get cocky. It stands for pig-headed and dumb. Oh, thanks a lot. If any of you know Metropolis Club in D.C., I led a meeting that night down at Metropolis Club, and I told them I got my PhD, and their response was, "It just stands for poor, helpless, drunk. Shut up and tell us your story." No respect at all. But that's okay. As I think back, All these degrees coming from a 1-9 in high school, a associate, a bachelor's, 3 master's, a PhD. I'm nationally certified as a criminal justice specialist, a clinical psychopathologist. I have my real estate license. I've got I'm an NRA instructor. I don't know. I've got all these certifications. I've never stopped trying to prove that one teacher wrong back in 10th grade. There's one thing that started to take away that negativity. They are not instruments of torture. They are steps to healing. And they are the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you do the 12 steps, honestly, completely, with a good sponsor who has worked the 12 steps according to this big book, your whole life will change. You can't change what you did before. I mean, there's stuff I look back and I'd love to change it, because it was horrible. And I'm embarrassed by it. It all changes. Now, I've got some crazy advice. One thing was, find a sponsor you can relate to. Don't do that. Find a sponsor that will be honest with you, that will not cut and negate or water down the message. My first sponsor I got because I could relate to, he played rugby, so I joined the rugby team. When it came time and hassles hit me, negative things hit me, what did we do? Talk about rugby? We didn't talk about the 12 steps of AA. So it didn't help. Then I got 2 sponsors. And what I would do is tell this sponsor what I knew he wanted to hear, tell this sponsor what I knew he wanted to hear. Neither one of them had the full truth, so I didn't get better. I didn't get those promises you talk about in the 9th step. Then I got another sponsor. And I didn't tell him everything either. Finally, at almost 9 years, I was the program chair for the meeting in Hagerstown on the convention. And that's where I met Frank. I had not had a sponsor probably for about 6 months. And right before that, I had walked into a meeting. I don't advise you to do this either. And it was a big meeting. It was an open discussion meeting. And I raised my hand. I said, I give everybody permission to take my inventory. Oh, my God. Every sickness, everybody who had unresolved issues, dumped them on me. Because, see, if I can dump my issues on you and point out things in you, I don't have to look at me. That's the last thing I'm going to do is look at me. It's much easier to look at you and make fun and pick and pick and pick. That's not the answer. And that's what they did. And I did not go back to meetings for 6 months. But I'm a man of my word, and I kept my commitment to that program chairmanship. And I went to the airport in Baltimore, picked up Frank. Within 15 minutes of him being in the car, he had gotten into my heart, and I started crying. You see, when I picked up that first drink, it was like taking the key to my heart and blocking the heart. It was like taking the key to my head and locking my head and throwing away the keys. And I would not let my heart get attached to anything or anybody except through alcohol. Nobody could tell me anything because I knew it all and it was locked into my own little brain. And I would make the decision what's best for me. And I became stubborn and arrogant and disrespectful. Frank knew the combination. The combination was Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12 steps of AA. That's how he got in so quick. 2 weeks later, I called him. I said, Frank, will you be my sponsor? And he said, sure. Are you willing to do anything I asked you to do? At that point, I had hair down on my shoulders. I had a goatee. And he says, well, fine, call me tomorrow. All right. Click. Next day comes, I dial him up, call him. Hey, Frank, you said call you today. He says, remember what you said yesterday? I said, yes. that you're willing to do anything I ask you to do. Right? Cut your hair. What the hell's that got to do with staying sober? And I went off on him. He said, fine, if you're not willing to do the small things I ask you to do, when it's time to do the big ones, you won't do them either, so get a new sponsor. Click. He hung up on me. That ass. Boy, he ticked me off. But I wanted what he had, so I called him back and said, okay, I'll cut it. So I cut my hair. Call me tomorrow. I call him tomorrow, and next day he says, shave. We went through the same thing again. So I shaved. He goes, you're not to be different than other people in the room. If you're different than other people in the room and the other people I sponsor, then you don't have to do the same things that we have to do, and you'll go out and drink. You can't afford to do that. Just follow a small few suggestions, and it's not a big thing. You can stay sober with a beard. You can stay sober with hair. Well, most of it's gone, but it's the idea of following direction on little things. Can you do it? Or do you want to argue about everything? Well, no, I don't need to argue about anything. Okay, then just do it. So I did that. Now, he gives me all kinds of wisdom. I get in these things that interrupt recovery. Anybody been in the yeah, but syndrome? I got into it bad one day. And everything he said, I had a yeah, but for. Ed, you got a car. Yeah, but. Ed, you got a house. Yeah, but. Ed, you got to clean clothes to put on. Yeah, but. Ed, blah, 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 blah. Finally, he says, Ed, you're a butthead. And I hung up on him. Then I called him back. He says, why'd you call me a butthead? He said, I called you that because the only difference between your head and your butt is smart enough to get rid of the crap and your head keeps it. Oh, I didn't want to talk to him for 2 weeks. Gives me all kinds of stupid advice, like he told me I majored in the wrong subject. I said, what do you mean? Because I majored in special ed. He said, you should have majored in proctology. Excuse me? He goes, yeah, that way you know how to get your head out of your ass. He's always telling me I think too much, and I whine too much, and I focus on the negative too much, and it doesn't work. And it doesn't. If you're like me, I have this little voice in the back of my head. And I call this voice Slewfoot. And Slewfoot has a way of negating everything that's positive. Now, there's a committee, and the committee doesn't always talk now because you've kind of drowned them out. But Slewfoot always can be heard louder than everybody else. And it's kind of like this. I had a really great day. Things went well, I got compliments, I got a raise at work, I got a promotion, whatever it was I got, and I kneeled down before going to bed and I say my prayers, thank you Lord for the gifts you've given me today, for the promotion and all the stuff you're allowing me to have, and I get into bed and I lay back and Slewfoot says, remember that prayer you just said? God didn't do that, you did. You don't need God. Wow. Self-reliance, control, that will kill you. Remember how your boss tried to keep you from getting that promotion? She's not your friend. That'll kill you. Or you have a really good day, and you lay down and you're feeling satisfied because you did something good for somebody else, and Slewfoot says, it wasn't as good as you thought. They're all talking about you. Little crap. Ankle biters. They'll take you out. Wow, they really will take you out. What I've come to conclude, and this is me, if you're new here, less than a year, you tell me you have a sponsor, but you don't call them, you don't have a sponsor. You tell me you're working the steps, you shouldn't have to tell me which step you're working. I should be able to see it. If you're working step one, I should be able to see you going to meetings. I should be able to see you making coffee, sweeping up the butts outside or wherever you're smoking these days. doing service work that gets you into the program more, going to meetings on a regular basis. If you're working step two, I shouldn't be seeing somebody who's trying to control stuff. If you're turning your life and your will over to the care of God, I shouldn't be seeing you standing outside in a little circle talking about the person who didn't come to the meeting tonight. And if you're on step four, I shouldn't see a person filled with fear, because it says fearless moral inventory. Wow. These really are instruments to healing. So you don't have to tell me what step you're on. I want to look and see it. It's an action program. It's not a thinking program. I've gone through a lot in recovery. I've been given a lot of gifts. I've had three close friends of mine in recovery commit suicide and kill themselves. One was a sponsee. And I carry around his suicide note with me all the time. I've had unexpected experiences. For example, I've been backstage with Metallica, with Ludacris, with Eminem, with Cypress Hill, with Linkin Park. How do I get backstage with all these people? That's amazing. If I was drinking, I wouldn't be anywhere near them. And the biggest thrill of all, and no matter what your political bent is, I was sitting at home one day, and I do sign language interpreting as well. And the phone rang, and this was in 1996, and I picked it up, and they said, "Is this Ed?" And I said, "Yes." "This is the White House." "Yeah, yeah, who is this?" "Call us back." And I hung up, dialed it back. "Good afternoon, White House." And I got paranoid. "What do you want?" They said, "President Clinton would like you to interpret for his inaugural ball." "You're kidding." So I had dinner with Bill and Hillary and Tipper and Al Gore and the Pointer Sisters and Alec Baldwin and all these people. And it was amazing. Now, can you imagine me drinking being near them? Would never happen. Unexpected things will happen to you if you don't pick up a drink or a drug. The most unexpected is this. I'll come near closing with this. You will meet people in this room that will cross your path, maybe briefly, maybe for a couple years, maybe 5 years, and there is absolutely no reason you can figure out why they crossed your path, except that they have a message to deliver to you that's going to make your life easier. If you listen. If you don't judge them, and you listen to the message that they carry, and may they be there a day, one meeting, they may be there 10 meetings. The first obligation I have is to listen to you. I don't want to listen to Sleuthfoot. It'll kill me. Now, I have a sponsor, Frank, and I also have a spiritual director. And my spiritual director with me only talks about my relationship to my higher power. And when I was going through some terrible things, I'm unemployed right now. I've gone through three jobs in the last 4 or 5 years. So my spirits are still up. I'm still looking. I'm doing what I'm supposed to do. Because this is what my spiritual director said to me. Three things. Number one, being human's not a character defect. It's okay to make a mistake. He's right. You're not perfect. I'm not perfect. Number two, God knows everything you ever did. And he loved you while you were doing it. That's true. And number three, you do not have the power, so much power, that the worst thing you can think of that you've done, that your higher power can't turn it into something beautiful if you let him. No secrets. Secrets will kill you. Tell your sponsor everything. Go to meetings. Don't pick up a drink or a drug. Don't put yourself in situations where you can, without thinking, allow Sleuthfoot to make your decision. And get a sponsor that you will be completely 100% honest with. If you walk around with secrets, it's like this wall. And people will not be able to get through that barrier because you won't let them. The big book says some of us tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil. You will not get those promises until you let go absolutely. Thank you very much. Thank you.